In the morning, I told you a bit about the various questions that we have in cosmology, and I tried to argue that for some of these questions, you really need to have theory and measurements that are very precise. I told you about some exact results that are there, and so now I'm going to tell you about recent attempts to try to make precise calculation on large scales, just to see how far we can get there. We can do. So you might think that if you are interested in finding the predictions from this theory on large scales, where things are close to the linear and the corrections are small, you can do things perturbatively, and this has a very long history in this field. Of course, starting with, for the most part, what we have learned about our universe is from solving these equations perturbatively and just stopping at the linear theory, right? So, even in the 1980s, there was an attempt that started, or even earlier, in the 1970s and so on, when the first measurements of large-scale structure were done. There were already attempts to try to make calculations to higher order. And the reason for that at that time was mainly, I suppose, that first of all, numerical calculations in computers were just not available. And second, that at the very beginning, when you were making the first measurements, there were small maps of small regions of the universe around us. So everything was quite in the nonlinear regime. People didn't have these huge maps where you could go to the linear regime. In fact, this large scale structure of the universe, in some sense, was discovered that you went to that there were these incredibly large, big structures, and until you went there, you didn't go into the linear regime. At the beginning, people were focusing on a small region where there were a lot of complications, and so you had to have the linear regime was not enough. So people started doing these calculations from early on. So how do those calculations more or less go? So as I was telling you, you're trying to solve this type of equations, and let's look for the moment at the equations of just in the form of hydrodynamics. You can see that you can solve this perturbatively. You can imagine that these terms, that density and velocity, you take them to be very small. So you solve the equations these have quadratic vertices. So quadratic nonlinearities in the equation, so cubic vertices, if you draw diagrams. And so you can imagine having some linear solution, plugging this in the quadratic term, solving again, and so on. And this is what people did for a long time. So you start with the initial conditions, delta and v are very small, solve for the evolution, then plug these as sources, the quadratic terms, you put them on the other side as sources, solve again, and plug that back in, and blah, 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 and you get a solution, right? And so these solutions, so the structure of these equations, then if you take the divergence of these equations, solve for delta and the divergence of the velocity, so it's two scalar equations, they look something like that. So there are some linear pieces, theta is the divergence of the velocity, and then some quadratic nonlinearity. So you solve the linear thing, you plug it in, blah, blah, blah. And so you end up with a solution that looks like that. There are various orders, the first order, the second order, blah, blah, blah. And they're in terms of the, so these are the initial conditions. And so you get a solution in powers of the initial conditions. So a quadratic solution, cubic solution. And in Fourier space, the solution of order n is just some combination of the solutions n to the nth power, the linear solution with some kernels in Fourier space that you get by just plugging back in and doing it. And then so people learn how to do this. So basically, you end up with a solution of the following form. The nth order solution after you've done this n times depends on the initial conditions with some kernels that people draw like this and anyway, so there's a solution. We've known them for a while now. And this solution just comes from doing this procedure. So another way of representing what's happening, you can imagine you take the two initial conditions, they interact, they get a second order thing, or you can imagine two first order solutions, they get a second order, they interact again, a third order. You build this thing in this way. Each time there is a vertex, it means that you're just plugging it back in and solving. So it's just standard stuff. So so when you want to compute the two-point function, you can do the two-point function in linear theory, or the first non-trivial correction is to do consider those diagrams that I've just written down there. So the second order solution. So what we are doing is then taking expectation values. So remember that this problem is a problem in which you have some sort of stochastic initial conditions. Okay, so these initial conditions are some random variable. You solve for this, and then you compute the averages, statistical average, two-point functions, three-point functions. So in this particular case, so if you solve for linear theory, you have, if you want, the initial, you have to compute delta of 1k, expectation value of delta some other k. If you do the linear theory, these are basically the initial conditions times the growth factor. So this is something like this. And there's something that you call the power spectrum, the initial power spectrum of the, this is, the initial conditions are characterized by their two-point function. If you want to go above the first non-trivial correction, is the following. So it will be something proportional to the square of the power spectrum. So something, so if these are Gaussian random variables, the next thing that is there is something proportional to the square of the power spectrum. And to do that, you need to do two things. You can compute the second order delta solution, which will be, as I said, some kernel, second order kernel times the initial conditions, two initial conditions. If you square, you need to now compute the next correction to delta delta needs to have four initial conditions to get the average. So you can take two of the second order solutions and square them. So delta two times delta two is one contribution. The other contribution is to solve the equations to the third order. You have three initial conditions and correlate this third order thing with a first order thing. So the delta one times the delta three. This is also, again, has four deltas. And so these are the two, so if you, four initial deltas. So in linear theory, the first order term is that one over there, which is just delta one times delta one, okay? So this, in total, you have two deltas. Here is the two terms that have four deltas, and then six deltas, and so on, okay? So this is the first non-trivial correction, the sum of these two terms is the first non-trivial correction. People, and you can also compute, for example, higher order correlations if you want to compute the bispectrum three-point function. What you need to do, for example, so you want to compute something like the correlation function of three deltas. If these are Gaussian random variables, three deltas gives average zero. So you need to have at least one of them that is not the linear one. So the lowest order contribution to this is when you take one of them to be the second order solution and two of them to be the first order solution, and you take that expectation value. This again has four deltas. This is called the bispectrum. And you can then compute the first non-trivial correction to this, so this had four deltas, so the first non-trivial correction to this statistics has to have two more, so instead of four, it needs to have six, and there are various options. You can take three second order ones, you can take a fourth order one, and two first order ones. You can take a third order, a second order, and a first order. Okay, so all these are all the first non-trivial corrections to the three-point function. So this thing is usually called the bispectrum. By translational invariance, is proportional to the delta function times something that depends on k1, k2, and k3. It's called the bispectrum, and so. This contribution is the lowest order one, and so on. Okay, and these are the first non-trivial corrections. So this is called the tree-level bispectrum, the first loop bispectrum. Here, the one loop correction to the bispectrum. This is the tree-level two-point function, the one loop two-point function. And these loops here just counts how many averages over the random initial conditions you have. Okay, so in the case of the two-point function. So these are the two possibilities, two second order, and you can take the two second order solution. You can draw the two second order solution like this. So this looks like a loop diagram, and so, or the third order solution, you can think you have three things, then you correlate this one with the other side, and again, so the one loop two-point function looks like that, basically. So it's And anyway, so that people have done for a long time. And similar story if you wanted to solve for the displacement in this form in which the equation is just like Newton's law, is the same story. People have figured out how to do it, blah, 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 you do it. Okay, so, but the question is, how good is this solution, okay? So, good. So, first, yeah. So then we need to compare these, so the two questions to try to answer is how then in practice how good these solutions are, and the second one, how well you might hope that they might be. And so if you want a simple estimate of how good these solutions, how big these different terms are expected to be, this does not quite work very well, but it's a first guess, is the following. So let's take the example. So for example, so the initial power spectrum, so maybe I should talk about the units for, so the dimensionless quantity is k cubed times p. This has no dimensions. Let's take that this is some sort of power law in k. Let's take that example where this goes to some power. Usually it's called n plus 3. So this is a dimensionless. You can see delta is dimensionless, but delta of k, the p. So remember, delta of k1, delta of k2 is delta function of k1, blah, 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 times the power spectrum. But so delta is dimensionless, is the overdensity. But delta of k is not dimensionless because delta of k is the Fourier transform, right? So it's d cubed x e to the ikx times delta of x. So if this guy is dimensionless, this guy has units of volume, okay? And so that's why you need to put this. P is not then not dimensionless. Okay, so when you work it out, this guy is dimensionless. I leave that as an exercise. Anyhow, so let's take the example. I told you that if the universe was Einstein de Sitter, it was always omega matter equals to 1, and the initial conditions were just a power law, then everything can only be a function of k over k nonlinear. That's it, because there was nothing with units of length, I told you in the morning. So if we said that then the linear power spectrum, so I let me compute the different loop corrections to the power spectrum. So the linear theory, let's say it goes like a power law like that. This is the definition of n. The first nonlinear correction is something that goes like power spectrum squared, okay? But by, this has to be dimensionless, power spectrum squared, it has to be the square of this. So it boils down, there's some coefficient here that we don't know, but it's this same thing, squared, blah, blah, blah. Each loop just gives you one more power of this times some numerical coefficient that can only depend as a, it can only depend on this index, okay? For a given index, you can compute that. But then you can see that if you wanted to know this to a given precision, you can figure out to what order you need to go because you know exactly the size, assuming these numbers are of order one, and they are, everything is okay. Yeah?
What takes KMM?
This is the initial condition. So in the initial, so remember I'm putting some stochastic initial conditions, and I'm saying, I'm assuming they are power law. So it's k to some power, n plus n, and then I have to normalize. So this is just the normalization. But define it, so you could also define it as, a, so it, it changes with time, this k nonlinear. So if I say that the in the initial conditions, so let me backtrack. If I say that the initial conditions, the initial power spectrum, p is some normalization times k to the n, the power spectrum of the linear theory, after a while, remember that in Einstein de Sitter, the density grows like the scale factor, okay? So the power spectrum at a later time is proportional to the scale factor square, just from two of these growths, times the initial thing, okay? So now this A needs to have units so that this has the proper units, but I can call the whole of this thing K nonlinear to the n, so if I just do k cubed here and then it's n plus 3, so it's the same notation as before. This is what I'm calling 1 over k nonlinear to the n plus 3, because it's just the k that at that time gives you delta equals to 1, okay? But it's all, it's a combination of the initial amplitude and by how much things have grown. So using that, you can figure out how what's the size of the relative loop corrections that you expect if the universe had a given n and was matter, always matter era. And then you can figure out good. But unfortunately, this doesn't work so well. This is the n, the value of, if I just take the logarithmic derivative of the amplitude of fluctuations of at different values of k in our universe, this is the plot. So you can see this n is not a constant, it changes a lot. So these formulas are, these estimates are not particularly very good. Even in one decade, the n changes quite a bit, especially, anyway, so. But okay, that there's something to. Good, so, great, so. Let me just, you do this calculation and you discover in our universe, you do this calculation and you get some answer and then we will check how good this answer is. But let me give you one point to remember about what is it that affects the, where is this? So, remember what, let's do the one loop. So the first non-trivial correction. So what does that mean? It means that I am computing the power spectrum at a given scale, okay? So I'm computing the correction to the power spectrum at a given k. And I'm averaging over the effects of the other modes that are not in k, okay? So in the linear theory, whatever I put in the initial condition at that k is what I observe at the later time at the exact same k. What I'm computing now is the first non-trivial correction from the fact that there are all these other modes of different wave numbers, and they're interacting with the ones that I have. Okay, that's the first thing that I'm computing, is the first correction due to these other modes. So the easy thing to think about is there is the k that you're computing the power spectrum or the two-point function at that k. And you can ask the question, let's call these other modes that I'm averaging over, so I'm computing the average effect of all these other modes. Let's think about the what, when you do the, I'm going to tell you what is it that matters, what's if I do the average, there will be contributions, effects from most whose wave numbers are much higher than k and much smaller than k and around k. But the easy ones to understand are the two limits. Okay, so let me tell you about the two limits. This just, you plug it in and you get the integrals, but I'm telling you. So what is the, so let's think, for example, so what about q's that are much longer wavelength than k, okay? So this is the following. So it's the k mode that is like this, and there's a long wavelength mode q, okay? So from the point of view of these high k modes, you can think that all that is happening is that the universe is more or less a little bit more dense or less dense by some sort of almost constant value from the point of view of these guys. So as you take this limit, this guy is a very long wavelength mode. And so all that's happening is that this K mode in some region lives in a universe with a higher omega. In some other region has a smaller omega. So the formula that you get is the following. It's basically a formula that says, oh, the power spectrum, how it depends on omega, okay? And then multiplied by the omega or the delta, the overdensity, so of this long mode, okay? And then average, square this and average, go to second order in this expansion. So it depends on the density changes that the long wavelength mode does. So what matters, the effect that the long wavelength has is to change the density. So the parameter that controls how big those expansions, those corrections are, is the level of density fluctuations that are produced by the long mode. That's the parameter. So in these units, so it would be the integral, is what I'm calling here for the long modes, the integral, the effect of all these modes is proportional to the integral of the power spectrum of all the modes up to that k. So all the density, the power spectrum of the density is the density of these modes that matters. So there's a parameter which is the density fluctuations produced by all the modes that are longer than you. Okay, that's one, that's how these guys affect. What about these guys? Well, from the point of view of a long mode, what is a short, these short modes, to the extent that, I mean, you're conserving mass, so the density itself doesn't really matter. If from the far away you put the same mass, you know, make it more dense or less dense, it doesn't really matter. It affects the gravity in the same way, okay? So it's not the density fluctuations of the short modes that matter, because that doesn't, you know, you can see that it doesn't matter. What does matter is by how much these short modes move things around. So these short modes shift things around and they act like a diffusion. Okay, so if you had now is the opposite limit. You have the K mode that is like that, and you have some short wavelength stuff. The fact, if the short wavelength makes some place denser and some place less dense, it doesn't matter, because from the outside, the mass, you only care about the total mass. But to the extent that they move things around, then it will start smoothing this out, for example. So the effect of the short modes is an effect of the displacement produced by the short modes, not of the density. So the parameter that controls the effect of the short modes is the integral, not of the power spectrum of the density, but of the power spectrum of this displacement that differs by some q squared. I mean, and so by dimensions, this is the parameter that enters. So you can see that you know, in reality, when we were saying there's just this one parameter, in reality, there are many parameters. The short modes affect things in this way. The long modes affect this in this other way. And so sometimes for a power law, if it's a power law and both of these things converge, it means that this one is dominated by the low k, this one is dominated by the high k, and you get the same answer. Because you evaluate this at k, both of them give the answer. But in our universe, that things are not a power law, these two things are not necessarily the same. And then you can also see that for some range of n's, if I start with a power spectrum which is a power law, for some range of n's, both of these integrals might converge. But there's some range if I make it a little bit steeper, then this one will not converge anymore. So This perturbation theory, these calculations, you can see that they only give you finite answers for some range of initial conditions. So this already is a little bit surprising because one thing that you can easily convince yourself is that if you take one of these examples, and say, for example, this diverges, then you can run the simulations, no problem. Nothing is bad about that example. It's just something wrong with the calculation. But in our universe, it happens to be the case that we live in a situation in which both converge, okay? Great, so, but these parameters are not, I mean, they're not all of the same. These are plots as a function of scale of these parameters. They're not of the same size because it's not a perfect power law. And so some of these effects are bigger than others. So, okay, great. So let me skip that. So when you do that calculation, just straight out, we forget about these potential problems. We just do it. What happens? Okay, so this is the linear power spectrum. And these are the two first corrections. The term that is the one times the third order, the second order squared, these are what they are. And so the two things to note, so clearly by the time this starts to cross, it's not believable, okay? But as I go further, I would hope that these corrections that I'm making are good, are a good estimate of what's going on. And you can see that this is steeper than the linear power spectrum. So as you go further like that, this guy becomes less and less important, okay? And what will happen if you do calculations to higher loops, higher, is that the place where things cross will always be the same, but the second, or you know, the two-loop calculation is even steeper, okay? So if I learn how to do these calculations, I will not learn what's happening here. That is out of the question. But if I move like that, if I've done this or that, then I get a big improvement, okay? And as I go like that, the improvement, if I were able to have everything under control up to two loops, the thing will go like to here, so I will have big, okay? This is the story. Okay. So, okay. These are the similar formula. Now, so this is what people have been doing for a long time. And in the last few years, we've trying to improve it because of the following reason. When you just compare those with the simulations, they don't do very well. Okay, yeah. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. So this is the problem. So in this field, we have been ignoring this until the last few years, and that is the reason why the whole thing was giving bad answers. But now we've fixed it. So and we need to take into account the fact that these equations that we are solving, and even the perturbative solution will not work on these small scales. These will have some effect that will. So we need to. Yeah, that's the source of the problem. But what I want to do is show you some places where you immediately see in your face that there's something problematic, and then I'll tell you more or less how more or less to fix it and the results that we have so far. But that's exactly the problem. But good. So it's not so profound. It's just anyhow. So let me just show you some examples of. These are examples. If you just do the same exercise that I told you before, but. Instead of for the density for this displacement, you can do for both. This I pick this plot just to show you. And here there are curves the slope of these things look different from the previous plot because remember the displacement and the density, they all differ by factors of k and so on. So, but that's what I want to show you is the following. So this is the linear theory power spectrum, both. Displacements linear, 1-3 and 2-2, where somewhere 2-2 here, are the first two corrections that I told you there. Then there are corrections of the next order, the 1-5, these add up to 6, so the linear add up to 2, then add up to 4, the first one loop, then add up to 6. So 1-5 something part of the two-loop calculation, 2-4 also part of the two-loop calculation. So here are terms that are part of the one-loop and two-loop calculations. Just to show you, look at this guy. This guy is one of the two-loop terms. It's just as big, almost, as the one-loop term, much bigger even than some of these 2-2 is supposed to be a one-loop term. This is supposed to be the two-loop term. They're just the same. So, and the reason why it's happening is exactly so what we were discussing before, but just so here I was saying, look, be careful if depending on what power spectrum I can put, perhaps this even diverges, okay? But you can think of these higher loop corrections as basically the same story as this, but where in this place, instead of putting the original power spectrum, you put also the one loop one to get a two loop. And so, but these guys are getting steeper and steeper. And so by the time I put the first one, this is starting to want to diverge, right? And that's exactly what's happening. And the reason why the 1-5 is giving such a large number is that you're putting here the one loop power spectrum. In our universe, nothing really diverges because, it's not a power law. It rolls over, and so it always will converge. But in reality, it's giving you more and more nonsensical answers because its higher loops are getting more and more of their contributions from more and more in the UV, in which this thing is, in any case, all completely screwed up. Okay, so in practice, I guess what had fooled people for a long time was the fact that you did this calculation, you get a finite answer for a universe. And people in this field were just, okay, they do the calculation and that's it. But then they compare and it was giving nonsense, okay? Of course, if you try to do it for power law, then the things all diverge, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so anyway, so that's what the story was. So, so let's see. So for example, this is an example of just the measurements of the power spectrum in a simulation with a particular N where perturbation theory diverges. So, you run the thing, it gives you something. It's nothing bad about it. So, okay, and so here's an example where you see, this is for our universe, this is linear theory. So this is just the dots are the results of the simulations, the power spectrum divided by some fiducial thing, okay? And the dots are what the simulation gives you, and you can see linear theory is this line, one loop is this line, two loop. It doesn't look like it's getting any better, okay? So it's always a disaster. I mean, it's just boing, boing, it goes around. And it's all because of this reason of the UV. This is even more amusing in the following sense. So if you just in a practical way, so if you look at this scale, it looks like the whole thing is a disaster. Linear theory, you can see one loop is on the other side, two loop is equally bad on the opposite. Things like here is completely out of control. Now, this is, on the other hand, the correlation coefficient between the density field in the simulation and the density field in the linear theory of this. So you just move the particles in the simulation using just the linear solution of the displacement, and you see how well they match. So correlation coefficient is something that is between -1 and 1. If it's 1, it means the two things are exactly the same or a multiple of each other, okay? So you're dividing, you do the... So it just means that they are if the correlation coefficient is 1, it means they are proportional to one another. And you can see that at 0.2, this correlation coefficient is super close to 1. So the two fields are just really, even though this calculation is giving nonsense, if you just take the simulation, you move the particles by the linear theory solution, the density you get out is 99% correlated. I mean, it's just a multiple. At this case, it's just a multiple of this simple thing. So obviously, how come you cannot really do better than this if there it's almost linear theory? So this whole story was a little bit screwed up. The other thing to, so there are two things that are contributing to the problem. One that has already been mentioned and was the, is the fact that the, even the equations that we are solving are not the correct equations on small scales. That's one. But even so, this perturbative series has a range of convergence. And there's even, even if the equations were perfectly, were the correct equations, you wouldn't, the perturbative series goes, after some time, goes out of the region of convergence. And in this example, what is shown is the following. So in the particular case, let's take a spherical overdensity as an exercise. You take a spherical overdensity. So this is, we know the exact solution because it's a spherical thing. It's like a closed universe, for example, or an open universe. You know exactly the solution. And the perturbation theory is nothing other than, you know, this is some sort of hyperbolic sign. I don't know, people, you probably see this kind of solution for the scale factor. So the perturbative series is nothing other than some Taylor expansion of that known solution. And you can see that, let's do the following thing. So if it's an overdensity and I plot the scale factor, it will expand and then it will contract and go to zero. Obviously here it's complete, the whole thing just breaks down. If it's an underdensity, it will get diluted. But this is this is if you want a series in time, and in the underdensity, it's the same as putting t2 minus t in the other solution. And so there's a point in which the underdense solution, even though it's not going through a singularity or anything, also fails to converge. And this is showing just that. If you just take, this is the full solution, and this is just the various orders of just the spherical collapse example at various orders, you can see that never converges. So anyway, this perturbative solution doesn't really converge to the right answer. And as a last example of this, there's in one dimension, if we are thinking of, if the universe were one plus one dimensions, then this perturbative series can be summed up analytically, okay? And then you can run the simulation and compare, okay? So you can do the, just to see, I mean, these are all exercises to see what happens. What you see there is the, you can, this one plus one dimensional solution, you can imagine a 3D universe made out of planes of matter moving around, okay? The point is that in the, if it's a plane, if it's planes of matter, their force is independent of their separation. So it's easy to, it's easy to solve the problem. It only has, the only thing you care about is when they cross. And so there is where the whole thing breaks down, the shell crossing. But other than that, if not the force is the same as, it doesn't, then you, anyway. So that example can be solved completely. Analytically, the series can be summed completely. And the simulations is also much easier to do. So this is the results from the simulation. This is the summing of all of the, this line, dark line over there, is the summing of all the terms in this series. So you can see they don't agree. Anyway, so. Okay, so great. So we know what's going on. So it's a mixture or a combination of not solving the right equations, problems in the short distance of the I'm not solving the right equations at short distances, the series doesn't even converge to the right answer, so I need to be able to fix that. And this I already told you. If you were to look at the, so the P15, the this two loop term compared to the one loop term, this is the integrand to see from what scales it picks up a lot of the contribution, and you can see that this two loop guy picks up contributions from scales from higher k, And this perturbation theory will stop being valid around somewhere around here, no matter what you do. So already the two-loop term, this one picks a lot of contribution from there, most of the contribution. If you go to even higher loop, it's even worse. And so at the one loop order, things are not so bad, because in any case, the most of the contribution is coming from here. And so yes, you're making some, this is this part of the integral in the normal solution is wrong, but okay, it's not the dominant part. So the one loop calculation is not as bad, but it gets worse and worse. Okay, great. So, okay, let me just say one final thing and then tell you how you go about fixing some of these problems. The other thing that you also realize is that, imagine I solve for the trajectories of this, I take a simulation and I solve for the trajectories of particles. And then the other option is I solve for the trajectories of particles for those same initial conditions with this analytical solution, okay? So what will happen? So, you know, I will get something reasonable, but what I will never get is, so things in the real universe, what happens? They collapse into objects, which then orbit, all the particles orbit around these halos that we call them, okay? So they stick together and orbit on a much smaller region. They collapse, okay? Now what happens in these perturbative solutions is that, yes, the particles go towards, so the blue dots are where the particles end up in the n-body simulation. The other dots is where they end up in various orders in perturbation theory. So yes, they go over there, but these orbits around here is you're never gonna get, right? So what actually happens is the first order takes you somewhere here, second order, third order, they always, you start doing like that, you go there, fine, and you never, these displacements do not get, it doesn't take you away to some other place, but it doesn't get you closer anymore, okay? So if you want, there is a irreducible mistake from the fact that in each place where you form a halo, you in this perturbative calculation, no matter what you do, you'll end up with some region of particles that is much bigger than where actually they end up. Okay, so that's kind of what happens. And one consequence of this, another interesting thing is that, so you might ask the question, okay, what is the formula for, so let's say there is this mistake. How many, so I want to estimate how much, or the contribution to the final answer from this kind of effects. So I would need to compute how many of these halos I have formed, and then in each of the halos there will be, you know, some mistake. It should be like that, but it's something like this. But the size of this term, of this mistake that I'm making, will be proportional, or will depend on the number of halos that I've formed of a given mass. So I want to bring this up because, I mean, there's a simple formula for the number of halos of a given mass that you form, or some simple estimate. It's called Press-Schechter mass function. I don't want to derive it for you, but remember that we are thinking that that the density, the point that I want to make is the following. We are thinking that the density fluctuations at the beginning are sort of a Gaussian random field. So let me call, this probability of having a given value of delta is proportional, probability of delta is proportional to e to the minus delta squared over the amplitude of fluctuations, which is this, is proportional, is something to do with the power spectrum, okay? So the more the fluctuations, the easier it is to get, you form something with delta is equal to one, roughly speaking. So to know how many, so this sigma squared depends on the mass, so you ask the question, what is the variance? So then this, the sigma squared is something to do with the integral of the power spectrum, dqk, up to a certain maximum number of, up to a k maximum to do with the mass of the object. But, so this is a simple, but I want to bring this up for the following reason. If you look at this formula, you see the following. The number of halos depends on the amplitude of the power spectrum here in the denominator of this exponential. And so the perturbation theory is a series in the power spectrum. Clearly, this term is not there, okay? Because you cannot expand this in small power spectrum, okay? So these are what people would call non-perturbative effects or something like that. So clearly they are there, and another place where this thing will not work. And this is not something I will, you know, I can, anyway. So there, all of these things have analog in other contexts. But so this is this effect of the halos. Okay, great. So the conclusion of this is that perturbation theory does not converge to the right answer on small scales for a variety of reasons. The equations are not correct. The series itself doesn't converge. These loops get a progressively more, as you go to higher loops, more and more contributions from these scales in which your answer is wrong. So it gets worse and worse. And now, there are also these non-perturbative effects. But also, the one thing that is helping us, on the other hand, is the following. What is actually happening is that things stick together. Okay, that, you know, in this particular example, the UV completion of this thing is that things stick together. So they affect less the large scales that you... It's not that, I mean, for all we know, the small scale dynamics could be anything. But in this particular example, is things, when they meet, they just stick together into some small blob that then becomes much denser, right? So in that sense, in certain sense, the corrections are smaller than you that might like, for if you think of this on large scales, well, the effect is smaller. The effect of this uncontrolled, the things that you cannot compute, you know, of how things are moving around on large scales is not as bad, because in any case, things are sticking together. Okay, in the simulations are even smaller than what I get it in the perturbation theory, but it would be much worse if when things got together, they exploded and they moved apart into very big distances, and so it pollutes every large scale. The sticking together means that they don't pollute as much. So that's a good thing. But anyway, that still we have all of these problems. Great. So this is the situation. And so what we have been trying to do is try to incorporate these effects of the small scales into the perturbation theory. Great. So, and this is what is called this effective field theory large scale structure. It's slightly different for technical reasons than standard effective field theories, and so is, so this contrary to the main technical difference is the following. In a regular field theory example, when you talk about modes of short scales, they also have very high frequency. Okay. And when you integrate them out, and the long wavelength mode are kind of some sort of adiabatic background on these short fast motions. Here is not the same. Every mode in the linear theory, for example, grows in time in the exact same way. It changes in a Hubble time. So this thing is not. It has a long, very long memory. So it's, if you want, it's not a theory. This effective theory will not end up being local in time, but it will remember the past a lot. The separation of scales between short and long is in the spatial direction, but the frequency is not. It doesn't work in the standard way. So this is a technical difference, and it has some consequences. But other than that, the logic is more or less the same.
Before I tell you one of the ways to think about this, so effective theory, let me tell you one other thing, which is the following, that I will try to incorporate the effects of the short wavelength dynamics into the long wavelengths, what they do, but it's not something that I can calculate from first principles, right? The whole point is that I don't know what those are. So inevitably, this leads to some free parameters. So So it's not that I will be able to magically, for example, in this case, know the sizes of halos. It's just that is not some in my perturbation theory. I'm not getting that, so I have to get it from somewhere else. So there will be parameters that I have to get from somewhere else, either a simulation or the observations themselves. But so what this perturbation, this effective theory, will buy us is that we know it's a characterization of the size of the or the scale dependence of how these different mistakes affect the large scales. I will know how this depends on scale, but the overall normalization of whether the mistake is a 1% mistake that goes down, I will know that my mistake goes down with k as k to some power. Okay, I will learn how to calculate these powers and how they enter in various statistics in the bispectrum, in the two-point function, blah, blah, blah. I will learn all of that. But is the mistake a 1% mistake, a 3% mistake? Those, I don't know. So I will inevitably have some, but this will be, you know, mistakes of a given form, which will enter in all of these statistics. And so if I fix it in one, I can check in the other, these kind of things. And I can check as a function of scale. But there will be free parameters. There's just no way around it. So, because the thing doesn't work, yeah, on small scales. So, there are various ways of getting to these effective theory equations that we are trying to solve. But one way is the following. So, imagine that. The problem is that the equations that we have are not valid on very small scales. So one option is to try to solve, instead of solving, so imagine that you had the simulations. So let me think in the terms of some simulation, okay? That I'm trying to match some simulation, or the universe. It has a lot of particles that start here, okay? But I know that the dynamics on small scales of these particles, I will not be able to follow, okay, with this equation. So one strategy would be, why don't I first combine these particles into the big blobs, sufficiently big, and then follow just the center of masses of these blobs, okay? So I'm smoothing those equations. Basically, I take the equation and smooth them in some way. Now, what is the problem that if I do that, it's great, then I'll have some equations for the center of mass, but now these guys are finite size objects. So in a sense, for example, they will, as time evolves, they will move somewhere, this guy will move somewhere, but it will change its shape a little bit. So it will have, say, a quadrupole moment. So the gravity, the way it will make a force on somebody else, it will not just because of its mass, but it will also have the quadrupole moment, the octopole moment. And so basically I'm making a theory. This effective theory is just the theory of extended objects, okay? With the the problem that I have is that the shape of these guys is not something that I can compute. Okay, so I need to somehow get a sense of the shape of these guys. But basically, I'm trying to solve for the dynamics of things that have a quadrupole moment and to the lowest order. If I want to fix the one loop calculation, for example, I need to think just of the quadrupole moments. And it's not surprising. I told you that the effect of the short wavelengths was this moving around of things. And so this moving around of the short scales is what is making this into some extended object. Okay, so, and then but, you know, as I go on scales much larger than the size of the object, this extended object, this size of the corrections will decrease. So this is the effective theory, if you want, is an expansion in wavelength or in k times the size of these objects. Okay, so on large, so it's this first order correction, because it's a quadrupole, is proportional to the size of the thing squared. So it will have the first correction will be on for a wave number of order k will be down by this kind of factor. Okay, so that's what I learned. That's what one needs to learn how to do. So at the end of the day, in this particular formulation, What I need to know is I've divided this into regions with a given shape. What's important is the quadrupole moment, octupole moment, blah, 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 okay? I need to say something about them in order to be able to solve these equations. Now, this, as I was telling you, is not something that we know how to compute, but it would have two contributions, if you want. One contribution, so the quadrupole moment of this region, it will have perhaps some random contribution that I don't know how to calculate. There will be some random thing. But then if this guy is sitting on some long wavelength mode that is producing some tide, this will deform the object. So there will be some response of this quadrupole on the external tide. So if you want, this quadrupole will be, say, proportional. There's a constant of proportionality times the tides, the external tides, plus some random qij random, which just depends on the small scales inside of this and is different for this guy than this guy. So there's a completely random contribution, and then there's a contribution that each of them is getting deformed by the long wavelength tides, which is the thing that I am calculating, right? So I'm computing the long wavelength. So this part I am computing, and I don't know this coefficient, so there will be one coefficient that tells me the quadrupole, how it responds, how much of a quadrupole I get when I have a given external tide, and then there might be some random contribution, okay, uncorrelated with the external tide, just some, in other words, and this I can continue in an expansion of in derivatives, okay, so this is the lowest order thing that can contribute, but I can have also with two more derivatives, so I will make a model of the external ties and the various and the quadrupole, octupole, and so on in terms of the long wavelength derivatives of the long wavelength thing that I'm computing as part of my theory with some free parameters and then this random part. Okay, this let's forget about it for a second. Okay, so So in the case of the quadrupole, there's these two pieces: the response to the long wavelength modes that I have, that is the part of the calculation. What I am tracking, I'm always tracking the long wavelength, and then some small scale stochastic noise. And this, so great. So in Eulerian, if I'm solving the equations for a fluid, is more or less the same story. What will happen is that, so before I was solving the equations for a pressureless fluid, just dark matter, but now these random motions on small scales, they act making this like a fluid with some stress tensor, which is not, with some motion. So the stress tensor is not zero pressure, okay? So there is a tau ij. This guy I will have to model somehow. I will model it as depending on, again, on the external tides and so on, this with a bunch of free parameters, and perhaps there is some sort of also random noise that I don't know how to compute. But there's a one-to-one mapping between those things. So now basically you smooth the dynamics. Now the dynamics is no longer the one of the or that you started with, but a different dynamics, and you solve these new equations. And what you can see is that, in a sense, all of these divergences that appear in perturbation theory, they have exactly the same structure as these terms that you have here. And so they can always be, reabsorbed into a redefinition of these things. Okay, so now, in a sense, now you have this theory now has acquired many more vertices, and all of these divergences that you see can always be they renormalize these parameters, and then the finite part of those parameters, if you want, is just the part that okay you have to calibrate in some way. Okay, so good. So. Let's see. So this is now an example of. When you do this calculation at one loop, it ends up being the case that all that the only if you count you're now counting powers of these derivatives, the term that is needed to fix everything is just one parameter and to do with the quadrupole. I leave you for you to go read some of the papers, but at one loop, that's what you have, and so this just shows you what I was saying before. So these guys now the mistake, the error over the nonlinear power spectrum now in this one parameter family. This is what you get in linear theory, and let's just look at this dashed line over here. This is the error now. This is for the displacement after you've done now this one loop calculation, and you can see this now. So before I told you the sizes of the different terms and what you might expect, but if you were to compare with before doing this fix, it didn't work out. So as expected, but now after. When I do this model, what this is showing is the following. I take a simulation, and I compute for that simulation what the density would be according to this perturbation theory, and I take the difference between what it really is in the simulation and what I got for that realization. So I don't have any kind of I don't have any cosmic variance or sample variance because I'm computing for the exact same initial conditions, the two examples. And this is the power spectrum of the difference between those two things. So between the calculation for that box and the perturbation theory for that box. And you can see how as you go, so you know, somewhere here is order one mistakes. By the time we get to here, you know, this is 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4, okay? And you can see how the slope is changing, okay? And so one loop, zero, linear theory, one loop, and somewhere I have some plot with the two loops. So where you have to introduce, so here is another example. This is for that was for the displacement. This is for the density. And so you can see in this linear theory, one loop, two loop, okay? Then at some point you don't make any, you know, the errors are big, order one. By the time you get here, they're order one. These are two orders of magnitude. So somewhere here is just one. But so here, do better calculations, you don't gain anything. But what you gain is this change in the slope as you move along. Okay, and So, but it's at the so this theory has some free parameter. Okay. This is another showing of the scene. Yeah.
I'm confused. So have you accounted for the non-perturbative problem or?
The non-perturbative, So in a sense, this non-perturbative thing is putting a floor on this. So I don't know if I have a plot like that, but as I go to higher loops, what I will discover is that, this stuff is, so as you go to sufficiently small scales, you're dominated by this non-perturbative mistake because you're dominated by what happens inside of the halos. It's what we call in the cosmology is called the one halo term. So this is all this non-perturbative term, but it's pretty steep. It's even steeper than this. So the non-perturbative term goes like that, and so still at two loop you are still gaining, but three loops probably you're not gaining anymore. You're hitting the non-perturbative thing, okay? In our universe, at least, this very much depends on n and stuff like this. But in our universe, this is still under investigation exactly. So here it's very clear, but we don't have an independent way of calculating. This formula that I gave you is some estimate of the non-perturbative terms. We don't have an independent way of calculating the non-perturbative term. we are associating it with the place where this thing is failing. Okay, so it's a little bit circular. But on the other hand, that estimate is not unreasonable. So that estimate tells you that so that estimate gives you a curve that looks like that. So you know, steeper than this one, but not as steep as the three loop, more or less nearer than the three loop. So, and indeed, when we include terms that are of the size of the three loop, this we have done for the displacement, not for the density, but we don't see much progress anymore. But this we still debate because it could be that we are screwing up with the numerics or something. So that's kind of some of where we are now. So, okay, so the general lessons of this approach are that, okay, the small scale dynamics is not captured by the standard perturbation theory, but it's easy to add, you know, we know the structure of the mistakes, it's easy to see what it should be more or less, or at least it's easy to see what it should be at the first few orders. The general thing is a little bit more I think it's a little bit more, it's not obvious to me that we are sure that we know the structure of this additional interactions that, for if we wanted to do what you know, infinitely higher loop calculation, mainly because of this difference of the memory. Okay, so if this was just a local field theory, we would just copy from some other book, but it's not, and so we are a little bit nervous about certain little technical aspects. But for the one loop and two loop, it turns out that they are simple enough, these counter terms, that this complications do not arise. So, but after that, there are still some issues. Let's say that we understand the structure of these terms. We know the number of parameters that need to be fixed, but you know the problems that we have is that okay, this non-locality in time that I was telling you, the fact that these things have a lot of memory. And also that as you go to higher loops, you end up with a proliferation of many of these parameters. Also, quadrupole, octopole, and then if you start writing this quadrupole and octopole in terms of the you're putting more derivatives, there are more tensorial combinations that you can make up, and so it looks like an explosion of this composite. So I don't know. But so we are fighting with these things. But at the level of the one loop and the two loop, it's okay. This is one loop for the power space. So what the calculations that have been done so far is one loop and two loop of the power spectrum, one loop of the bispectrum. That's what has been done so far. And also one loop. Then there are other questions that I haven't discussed here, which are calculations for tracers, not the dark matter, calculations in redshift space, because we don't really measure distances in megaparsecs, we measure them in redshift, and this involves the velocity. Some of these things have been included, redshift space distortion, at some order. So, I mean, this is still very much work in progress. We have done some of these calculations, some we have not done. The numerics is not, I mean, I guess the problem that, our goal is to establish whether or not you can, you know, make calculations that are, you know, for these futuristic small scale effects. Say we have things under control at the 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4 level. Okay, that's our goal. Now, at this level, even though we are, for this comparison, we are just comparing for simulations of dark matter that alone, just because as an exercise for the moment, because that are simulations that are done from first principles, we see artifacts on the simulation at this level, and so it's difficult for us to know if, you know, there's something wrong with our formulation, if there's something wrong in there. I mean, we are messing up. And so then also, it's not super clear how, you know, where exactly this should fail. We know it, of course, it will fail in the nonlinear regime, but where exactly it should fail. And we have some free parameters there. So we are fighting to understand, you know, are we in some sense getting too rosy results because we are overfitting things because of the free parameter. Because of course the test is to make sure that you on the very large scales where these structures are very well understood, you see these improvements. But then these effects are so small that then you cannot trust the simulation so much. Then you go here and then you don't know if you are still, you do the calculation to two loops and you don't know if the three loop would have been important or not until you do the three loop and so on. So, okay, so it's still work in progress. But I think, okay, one loop is super under control, two loop is pretty good, and then has not been more. And so at some level, the two loop is good, but the error bars on the two loop, which is the three loop calculation, that we don't really know. Now, we have guesstimates of the size of the three loops based on if the universe was just power law, then you would get these estimates, but the universe is not exactly power law, so blah, 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 complicated. So, but, yeah, so... So that's about the effects from the UV. Okay, so more or less where we stand with the effect of the high momenta. But then another thing that we've been trying to make progress on is effects from longer wavelength mode where the perturbation theory should be okay, but so let's go back to something I said this morning, which was that in this BAO peak, you still see big effect in the smoothing of the peak, even though this is supposed to be very much in the linear regime. Okay, so how is this possible? Well, that is because there is some other parameter which is not that small, which has to do with. So, okay, what's the point is the following. This is at 100 megaparsecs, very large distances, but it's quite narrow. It's 10 megaparsecs or 20 megaparsecs of width. Now, the random motions from this nonlinear collapse is also a few megaparsecs. So compared to the width is more or less order one, okay? So that is... the parameters in this perturbation theory, we are counting every power of the power spectrum as if it were the same. However, sometimes it combines in a situation in which there's this scale in the problem, it combines into ratios of the width of this peak to the RMS displacement, which is an order one thing. Okay, so you don't want to treat that thing perturbatively. Okay, if you can, you want to add them all up, and that's it's really just an exponential that you're summing up, and so this converges if you add more terms. You don't really need to add too many more terms, but you can isolate those diagrams and sum them all up together, and this is what is called this IR summation. So this is Just to illustrate one thing. So this is the correlation function that you expect in the linear theory, okay? And as I told you, if you see in a simulation, it got broadened, is the points here. So not only do you need to add a lot of terms, but naively people usually had just done, didn't take this into consideration and just say did the one when they did the so when you do the one loop when you do the one loop correlation function, you've included the first this correction to the first power. What do you get? You get this dashed line. Okay, so because you didn't not only not adding them not add so there's a particular subset of diagrams which you really need to add, you know, a lot of them to reproduce this, okay? But those diagrams were counted in the standard way with the same parameter that counts the other one. So it was just this distinction of parameters was not made. So usually you were only computing in those diagrams just the first correction. When you did that, you get the dashed line. And so people were saying, okay, the whole thing for the BAO is just a disaster. It will never work because look, okay? But it turns out you can isolate them, add them all up, and it's okay. So that's another thing to that we have learned how to do. So and this is similar in the power spectrum. I will not go through this. Let me finish now by saying. So, summarizing in the following way. So, I think there are a few questions in cosmology that will require very precise measurements and precise calculations of the large scale structure growth and so on. And I think there is still quite a bit of progress to be made in being able to do these calculations better. And I'm hopeful that that in the next few years we will have sufficient tools to be able to do these calculations to this kind of accuracy that is needed, both for the power spectrum, the bispectrum, and so on. But there's still quite a few things to be done. Okay, let me stop there. Any questions, anybody?
Yes,
so so if you look at the dispersion relation of these modes, it's not omega square equals k square or something, but everybody, in fact, it's as if it were omega equals to zero. Everybody grows as a power law, A of t, okay, independent of k. So the time dependence is the same for every mode, and they grow in a Hubble time. So so these modes, there is no sense in which you can take the long modes as some background that evolves slowly and these guys move fast. Okay, that doesn't work. And so now, what are the formulas that we are writing for example, in this particular, the way I introduced it, I said, I'm following some particle which now has some shape, it has a quadrupole moment, that is depending on time. Okay, so in a situation in which it would be a local thing, you would write, say for example, that this is what I actually wrote there, which is there is some tides. Given the tides, it deforms. Say this is like a star. It deforms the star instantaneously, and so this guy follows the external tides. Okay, with some parameter L square of t. Okay, so there's the response. Let's just even forget about it. So if the tides are at a given value today, at this point, the multiple moment is exactly the same. So, but that is not very realistic because of this problem. And so in reality, it's more like the tide today is an integral along the trajectory of the particle, d tau, of some response times the tide at the previous time along the trajectory, right? Di, dj, the phi at the location of this particle x of q and t prime. Okay, I don't know, t prime, dt prime. So there might be some response here, but I should integrate along its old history. And so in reality, I have to put terms kind of like that. And because at the beginning it's just one parameter, and in any case, these solutions are of the structure of this solution for the gravitational potential is that, for example, in Einstein de Sitter, it goes like A times the linear gravitational potential plus some A square times a second order piece, phi second order. Then when you plug this, you can do the integral. So it doesn't lead to much of a complication. But the moment you start. Now, this guy affects the motion. In perturbation theory, you need to put this into the new motion that will affect again, and then you start getting out of control. And so at some point, So, you know, this is what we are doing now. And I mean, you can see that it's important that this is like that in order to fix the to get all the structure of the divergences, for example. It's important that, so if you were to do that, you will not get every term as it's supposed to be. So you clearly see that you need to do something like this. Now, okay, we are making it as we go along. So perhaps there is a more systematic way of thinking about it, and there's an analogies in other context. So this is kind of what we have done so far. Yeah. Yeah, sure. Now the gravitational waves are very small, no? So if there was a strong background of gravitational waves, you might want to do this on the scales that we are caring about. The even if there was a gravitational wave background super high as that we bicep would have seen, it would not do anything. But this also these gravitational waves, I guess, also illustrate a little bit of this memory effect. So for the UV thing, it doesn't make any difference, but the gravitational waves, but people have talked about something they called fossils, and this is and it illustrated the memory of this. So let me tell you about that. So imagine you have a background of gravitational waves. Okay. So what happens? So they are, and let's say they are more or less of the same size as the density fluctuations, 10^-5. What happens is they are, you know, there's 10^-5. They become of the size of the horizon. They start to oscillate and they redshift away. So a given, let's say now we are talking about gravitational waves that are much smaller than our Hubble today, their amplitude is much, much less than 10^-5 because they have been redshifting since the time they entered the horizon. So today, they see no, they do not affect the large scale structure at all, okay? But when the gravitational wave was comparable to the horizon, then it was a 10^-5 effect. It is as if you were a short wavelength mode at that time, you were living in a universe in which you had a gravitational wave more or less of the size of Hubble, which basically will generate a universe for you that is not isotropic. So some sort of Bianchi type universe and isotropic, you're living in there. And so during the period of time where the gravitational wave is still 10^-5, so for one Hubble time or so, you will get affected by it. The growth of structure will be slightly different by of order 10^-5, okay? But remember, so it's a small effect, but remember how this, so in linear theory, the density is just growth with the scale factor with some sort of initial conditions. Now what's happening here is that there's a little bit of a period of time in which the growth factor is affected, and it's anisotropic because of this gravitational wave. Okay, so there is, let's say, a gravitational wave here. I'm now going to discuss what happens to short modes over here compared to short modes over there. Okay, the short modes over here, they see one gravitational wave. It's anisotropic, the universe in some way. So some modes grow a little bit faster than others, depending on during the time the gravitational wave is of order of the horizon. Depends on the relative decay of the short mode compared to the decay of this wave. The angle will make the things grow a little bit by a factor of 10^-5, okay? So different here from there, okay? But after that time, okay, sometimes so the growth of structure is just multiplicative, okay? So if here, after there is this gravitational wave, it entered the horizon, it made these two regions different by 10^-5. After that, there was a lot of growth, but it's just a multiplicative factor on top of it. So forever, when I measure the short modes here and the short modes there, they remember that they got this little kick of 10^-5 when the gravity wave entered there. So even though today the amplitude of this gravity wave is completely gone, I could not see it. It's much below 10 to the minus 5, let's say. There is a surviving effect forever of the gravitational wave on the large scale structure forever of 10 to the minus 5, an isotropic thing, very, very special kind of effect because it has this, because it's a tensor, you know, the angular dependence of with the you know, it's just a very special anisotropy that I'm putting on every single mole, by the way, because, you know, if I have an anisotropic universe with a different, say, it's like a, let's say a universe that expands a little bit differently, every mode of every k, remember that this is independent of, you know, so what will happen here, every mode of every k will get a 10 to the minus 5 kick in the exact same way, anisotropic in the exact same way, which will be remembered forever, okay? So even though I don't have the gravity wave today, I perhaps can dig and see that every mode that was in this direction, all of them are a little bit 10 to minus 5, you know, higher amplitude than the ones over there, okay? So I can try to search for that. But it's another illustration of this memory effect, so anyway. And it's not just for gravity waves. Anything that affects the expansion during some period of time will have the same effect. The nice thing about the gravitational wave is that it creates an anisotropic universe. So there is a way for me to tell that there's something fishy going on. If it's just something isotropic that just makes everybody higher by 10 to the minus 5, I don't know to start with what the amplitude was, so I'm not able to tell. But yeah.
In practice, could we use something like this to reconstruct the full history from a snapshot?
The full history.
What happens in time since this seems to get encoded?
Yeah, so in principle, probably. I mean, I guess. Yeah, in principle, effects like this are there forever. Now, in practice, the problem is that, for example, if there's this gravity wave that is 10 to the minus 5, it's a very small effect. So you can see it only statistically if you have, you know, a lot of modes. So I don't know how far it can be pushed. But yeah, I think there's a lot of information about things in the past there if we can. Get sufficient precision, yeah. Any other questions? No? Okay, thank you.